Good evening, all. Glad to see you all. I just had a quick look at the attendees, and I see that we've got people joining in from all over the globe, actually. I can see a number of people from the Netherlands and also Scandinavia, USA as well, and further afield. So it's great to see you all. I hope you've been enjoying the day, or will enjoy what's left of it. It's poured with rain all day today here in Burgundy. I've just looked out of the window. Still been cold every morning. We've had the cool air from the north wind since the 4th or 5th of April, right through to now. It's going to warm up at this weekend. But frankly, we need this weather to go away. We need to get a little feel of spring. So I'm going to try not to be gloomy throughout, however, even though Burgundy has really taken a knock, and the rest of France, and quite a lot of the rest of Europe as well, with the frost problems which have hit us since Easter Monday and the following Tuesday. What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about frost in general and then go into what's happened this year and what the possible solutions are and what we might need to do in the future. So here we are. First of all, I just want to make a few comments about what constitutes a frost. There are winter frosts and spring frosts, and there can also be winter freezes when the temperature just goes way, way down during the winter months. Not what we're talking about this year, but it affected most of France, a little bit less Burgundy, but especially Bordeaux and the whole of the south of France in 1956. It affected Burgundy in 1985 when the temperatures in January got down to nearly minus 30. They had to close the roads from heavy traffic because otherwise the roads were just disintegrating at those temperatures. And quite a few of the vineyards, which are lower on the slopes and are just up against the old N74 in the Côte Nuit, Chevry-Champtain, Clos Vougeot, those vines got so cold that they froze and burst and died. So people had to replant them, and then in 2009-10, in fact it was I think December the 18th, around then, in 2009, the temperature suddenly plunged to minus 22, but very, very quickly. And again, the same areas got frosted, and the vines that had been replanted after 85, quite a few of those suffered again. Those are very typical, and let's hope that we don't see them again. But I, in retrospect, rather stupidly, wrote in the first edition of Inside Burgundy that spring frosts appear to be a thing of the past. Well, that was really a hostage to fortune. And what have we had since? Nothing too bad in the first years of the following decade. Occasional frost risk, but then 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, not so much in fairness, 18 and 20. There were threats. There were moments when people had to start using their preventative measures, but nobody really lost much in those years. So the other years, 2016 was a really bad one. Very bad in Chablis, very bad in the Côte d'Or, and then a little less bad as you went further south, which was a relief. And that happened on we thought that date would be indelibly marked, 27th of April. So it was a little bit later than this year. But since then, things have got so much worse that we rather fear that we'll lose track of 2016 in the pantheon of worst frosts. So all the buds had come out by that time at the end of April. So when the frost did arrive, it probably didn't get as cold as it has done this year, but it really did widespread damage. We will return to that from time to time because it was a particular style of frost, and we'll want to look at that as we go along. 2017, actually a lot of France suffered. Bordeaux did, the Loire, Jura. Main part of Burgundy survived but had to use their preventative measures. It's just Chablis that suffered badly. 2018, we escaped. Just 2019, everybody was out there lighting their fires, preventing the frost damage on the 13th of April, only to discover that the earlier threat, which happened about the 5th of April, had already done the damage. And that was, it was not good, but it wasn't a disaster in the Côte d'Or, wasn't too bad in Chablis. Slightly weirdly, the area that really suffered was further south, Mâcon and even the Beaujolais, the northern Beaujolais, Moulin-Vent, got really badly hit. 2020 we escaped, and then along came the horrors in 2021. So why suddenly in the last 7 years have we had 5 years of at least partial, if not major damage? What's changed? I think we can look at this in two different ways. One is to do with the sort of macro climate, and one is to do with what's happening in the vine cycle. So the macro climate. We are expecting here in Burgundy and Western Europe in general, we are expecting that our main weather patterns come with the westerly wind direction, the famous sou'westers in the UK that bring the storms and warmth but wet. That tends to be, or has tended to be, the major prevailing part of our weather system. Well, normally we're protected from any cold air coming down from the north because you have powerful jet streams, which broadly speaking keep the Arctic cold up there near the North Pole. Now, with global warming, as I understand it, I'm not going to go into vast detail because it's not my special subject, and we still don't know exactly where it's taking us, but what appears to have been happening is that the poles have been warming up more quickly than the temperate zones, with the result that that has changed the airflow of the jet streams, which used to be a powerful and relatively consistent airstream running west-east, but it tended to keep the cold air up above it. Now, it's become a lot less consistent and a lot less strong as well. And this has meant that from time to time, we've had these vast swathes of cold air from the Arctic, which has descended down into Europe, also down into the States with that freeze that was discussed earlier this year in Texas, for example, and also, I'm sure, in other parts of the Northern Hemisphere. Very probably the same thing is happening in the South, but I haven't researched that. And when it does, it's a trump card which trumps the westerly air pattern. Broadly speaking, this happened around about Easter, and it hasn't moved away yet, though I understand it's due to quite soon. Now, that's going to lead us on to the different types of frost, excluding the winter freezes, when we look at what that massive cold air does. But the other factor that we have to get built into the system right up from the start is that the vine cycle appears to be starting earlier. Now, I've got two bits of research on this. One comes from my friend Lydia Bourguignon. Lydia and Claude Bourguignon run a research station here in Burgundy. And Lydia gave a presentation to the Académie Internationale du Vin. It was unpublished work, so I'm not going to put anything up on the screen. What I took away from it was that she researched four plots of vines all in the Côte d'Nuit, and she looked at the time of bud break, débourrement in French, the time of flowering and the time of harvest. And she took 10, or in fact 11 year periods, so 85 to 95 inclusive. The dates were 7th May for bud break, 9th of June for flowering, and 26th of September for harvest. The next 11 year period, 96 to 86, bud break had come forward by just 5 days to the 2nd of May. Flowering had come forward on average 8 days to the 1st of June. Now, bud break and flowering are things that you can measure and don't depend on a vigneron's choice. And the harvest had come forward about 10 days to the 16th of September. That's slightly different because a particular producer could change their policy as when they want to harvest. But then we come to the next 10 or 11 year period, 2007 to 17. And basically, the flowering doesn't change at all. The harvest doesn't change at all. But bud break suddenly advances by 20 days. So it's gone from the 7th of May to the 2nd of May, and now it's gone from the 2nd of May to the 12th of April. So that's a really big change. And that means that the vines are more advanced early in the season when the frost risks doing its damage. Because you can start to see the buds early on, but they're protected in a layer of cotton. And then they burst through that cotton, they break through, and it's after that that they're really susceptible to the frost. However, a different bit of research, which the very excellent Boris Chompy, who now has his own domain in the Oak Coat de Bone, which he showed me the other day. I'm now going to try and share that with you. That's what we want. I trust you can see that. This is the bud break date that has been recorded between 1941 and 2021, according to the SRPV, or Service Régional de la Protection des Végétaux. What's interesting here is you can see that it's really different every year, depending on weather conditions. That's understandable. But the dotted line is the average tendency. And you can see that from 1941 up to around about 1980-81, actually, the dates were getting later. And then from 81 onwards, they're getting consistently earlier, but in fact, ending up back where we were in the late, in the 1940s, which in fact was quite a warm decade, unlike the 50s that followed. So it's this second half of the curve which really interests us. That's what matters in terms of the danger of the frost coming up. So anyway, I'm just checking in on the chat. So good to see you all. I will just repeat that. And I see one or two people are saying what they are drinking alongside. I have poured myself a little glass of Saramin from Benjamin LaRue, partly because we opened it for a Zoom last night and partly because I did some filming with Ben in the wee small hours of the morning while his vines were being frosted. So it was a little bit of a difficult time for him, but he was very kind and helpful in explaining what was going on. I can see that a couple of people have put up questions and answers as well, questions rather, Q&A, and I will endeavour to weave those into the discussion. And Debbie Day has already asked about the finances of it. I'm going to talk about that right at the end rather than tackling that straight away. Okay, so we've got these two things going on, and now let's talk about the types of frost. And we get three sets of words which are bandied about, and they're broadly stick together. So you've got what they call a radiative frost, spring frost and the white frost, all of which are much the same. I don't think the overlap is exact. And you've got an advective frost, or a winter frost, or a black frost. That's the bad news, and that's what we got this year. But let me talk about those a little bit. So radiative is to do with the fact that the ground overnight, as it gets colder, will radiate the heat out of the ground, and heat rises, cold descends, and so you get the thermal transfer, and the cold comes down to the ground, and it gives you a bit of a frost. Those conditions are normally worst when you have a clear sky, and you tend to be talking about fairly low negative temperatures, so don't get well down below zero. And also, if there is any humidity about, when temperatures are below zero at the dew point, at that point you can see the white covering beginning to grow, which you'll see on the grass on your lawn when you wake up in the morning, or talking to Antoine Jobard when he was out in the early hours doing the frost protection stuff. He could see the frost growing on the grass in front of his eyes. He could see it moving up the stems of the blades of grass on the side of the road where they weren't trying to protect, as opposed to warming the vineyards, which must have been all a little bit alarming. So these frosts, you have to react against them. You've got to try and warm up the temperature or in other ways protect your vines. But normally your protective methods can work under these conditions. Advective, strange word, advective in French, and I don't think we sort of use it in normal language. Also sometimes described as a winter frost or a black frost, because you don't get the whitening of the vegetation. These are really bad news because they are to do with a massive cold air, such as we have been talking about, with the slight change in the climatic systems, And here you can get temperatures which go quite a lot further. And the real problem here is it's not just that the warm air from the Earth has moved up to a little bit above where the vines, etc., are. It's that there's a mass of air which is at all levels. You've really got to get plenty of meters above the ground before you find anything warmer at all. And at that point, stirring up the air, which is one of the protective measures, isn't going to do you any good. So that's really what we saw this time round. So talk perhaps then a little bit about the dates for this year, and then we'll talk about what the possible protective measures may be. So the dates, it began Easter Monday, was the 5th of April, and it had been really, really hot the week before. So the very end of March, very beginning of April, we were getting temperatures up into the mid-20s, and the vegetation, which had not been particularly in advance, because we had a slightly more of a proper winter this year. We got a bit of rain, for which I'm thankful, and we also got a coldish patch through February. Quite honestly, in the last two or three vintages before this year, seasons before this year, we were actually able to have lunch outdoors in our shirt sleeves in February, and that didn't really happen this year. So we were feeling quite optimistic, and March was pretty cold for the first 3+ weeks, and then the last week, temperatures changed, weather shot up. I didn't pay it that much attention because it was short term and I could see that the cold weather was coming back. But actually, it turns out that the vines really did leap forwards. And the Chardonnay in particular, because Chardonnay amongst white vines has a season which starts earlier than Eligote, and the whites start quite a bit earlier than the reds. So in an early frost risk year, then it's the whites that get it in the neck more than the red wines do. It wasn't the case in 2016 because it was later in April and therefore both colours were properly out. So the afternoon of Monday the 5th, Easter Monday, the weather changed. Early morning of the 6th, it got down properly below zero, -3, -4. Everybody had seen this coming. People had started to get their protective measures in place. And they probably worked on that occasion, except in the areas which are typically that much colder, frost buckets and up on the highest parts of the slope. You're lulled into a slight false sense of safety if you're just looking at what your car thermometer registers, because the car typically is going to be where it registers is a meter or so, maybe off the ground, a few feet anyway, a couple of feet. And it's right down at ground level that really counts. So people were gloomy, but thought maybe not too bad. However, the cold weather continued through the next day, and even by early evening, the temperature had dropped below freezing. Now that's unusual, and because more often you get the warning at sort of 1 or 2 in the morning and you leap out of bed and you rush out to the vineyards and you start lacing things up for sort of 3 or 4 in the morning, and so it goes. But here the temperatures were dropping below freezing shortly after dark, and we'll come to that when we talk about the preventative measures, what that means. But also a little bit of precipitation came through, and because it was below freezing, it fell in the form of a snow shower. Not everywhere in Burgundy, but we certainly had it in the Côte d'Aubagne, which meant that you had snow lying on the ground, and it meant you had an atmosphere of humidity. And that makes the cold worse in terms of doing damage on your nascent buds. So early morning of the Tuesday and Wednesday, and it so happens that I'd been doing some filming the day before with a cameraman for 67 Palmal TV, which will be coming up shortly. And I said, look, if you can stay overnight, and he lives in Lyon, but he's got family in Burgundy, so he said, yes, he could. We'll get up at 4 in the morning and go out and film a few things. So we did do that on the hill of Corso Charlemagne and then in Merceau Beni. And he took some great drone shots of the whole landscape being covered in the what the French call the bougies, the candles or sponge pots. And so we were there in the vineyards in the very early hours. It wasn't necessarily any colder than the day before, but the humidity was definitely having a more negative effect. And then the following day, it had dried out, snow had melted, a dry day, a little bit of warmth in the afternoon. Theoretically, it's better because we go back to the dry conditions, but the temperatures got down even lower on the early morning of Thursday the 8th. And that was when we had some minus sevens, minus eights locally, possibly, in the key zone where the vines are. If you're down at that level, it's a real struggle. Temperatures stayed cold the next week, and we had normal frost conditions on several days of the minus twos and threes. I know people hadn't got into complete despair. They probably continued treating a certain amount. And even at the beginning of this week, Monday of this week, we had a frost on our lawn here. Up in Chablis, they had frost in the vineyards, probably in the Côte de Beaune, Côte de Nuit. It probably didn't really get below zero. But by now, the vines are feeling pretty fragile. Not very happy with life. So Julien has asked, can you determine if frost will be radiative or advective beforehand? Yes, probably. And you can have both things going on at the same time. But I think you've got a reasonable idea. It's not a guarantee, but you can see from the weather conditions which it's more likely to be. Right. Just had a restorative sip of wine. Trust the rest of you are as well. So how are we in inverted commas, the producers, going to try and treat this? So I've got together a little list of the possible features that you can do, and also an indication of the cost. There are three things that count. What it costs, what its ecological effect is, because some of these things do pollute or use up lots of petrochemical energy. And the other thing, of course, is whether it's going to be effective or not. There's also a slight difference in Chablis compared to the rest of Burgundy, because Chablis has been used to spring frosts forever. And so it's put in place some permanent systems, which you can just press a switch or turn a tap and make them work. But nobody in the Côte d'Or has got those systems in place, nor indeed further south. So there are things you can do to prepare, which is you can prune later. Remember that Burgundy dictum is taitôt, taitard, rien ne vaut le taille de mars, which translates as prune early or prune late, nothing is as valuable as pruning in the month of March. The snag is that if you have a larger domain, you can't just wait until March before you start pruning, because then you'd need a massive workforce to get everything done in time for Easter. Il faut tailler pour Pâques, you should prune for Easter is the other phrase. What some people do though is that in their most frost sensitive plots, or indeed in their most valuable plots where it will matter to them more if they lose ground to a frost, then those are the bits where they will prune later. Other aspects of pruning are that if you don't tie your vine down to the wire, that may help it. So if it's sticking up, your shoot is sticking up rather than having been tied to the wire. Normally you would have tied it down by now. But if you don't do that, the advantage is that A, your shoot is sticking up, and so it is a little bit further from the ground where temperatures are colder. And B, it is not attached to the metal wire, and metal is a conductor, as we know. And if temperatures are below freezing, that metal wire is going to be conducive, conduct the cold temperature even more than the air will do. And therefore, it is going to make your shoot that much colder. So those are two reasons not to. And some people in Champagne, perhaps in Chablis, and certainly in Switzerland, have a habit of pruning with two shoots, one of which they may tie down and one of which they may leave free. And then if the one that's tied down gets clobbered by frost, they can use the other one as a replacement. If they find they don't need the other one because the first one didn't get frosted, then they can just snip it off. So that is a possible solution. One thing which was noticeable in the Mâconnais was that the vineyards there, which were tied down, suffered badly. Those which hadn't been tied down at all didn't suffer too much. And also in between those two, you had the people who were using the classic Mâconnais arcure system. So you can see here, if you follow me around, you can see here that you start with your shoot coming out of the bud. If you were in the Côte d'Or, you'd be tying it alongside this wire. But we're not in the Côte d'Or, we're in Mâcon. And so what you can do instead is do exactly what you can see in the picture of the shoot going up and coming back down again. Actually gives you more buds, because if you're in the Mâconnais, you might feel comfortable about a higher yield for your simple Mâcon Village than you would for your Meursault Premier Cru. But also you can see that the shoots and the buds and the leaves are higher up. So this was in the little village of Puy, in the Appellation Puy-Puisé, where I saw plenty of other vines that were damaged, but this one, after the frost, was still doing perfectly well. So that's one aspect. Inevitably, there is a school of thought that doesn't agree with the late pruning. Talking to Guillaume Guizot in Saint-Brie, he says that from the studies he's read, the problem is, if you prune late, the vine has already been sending out the sap levels to sort of the end of the vine. And if you then cut it off, it doesn't have that sap which it needs for its growth. And so it is slightly enfeebled. And also it will react by, in the following year, probably starting to develop even earlier because it was sort of held back in the current vintage. Whether or not that's true, I don't really know, but there may be some risks. The other factor is that if you haven't tied your shoots down and the buds and the leaves have arrived, when your workforce comes to tie that shoot down against the wire, there's a very good chance you're going to knock some buds off in the process. So manual handling, it's quite delicate work. If you just hired a bunch of guys, seasonal workers, to do it, who knows what will happen. If you, the boss, are doing it yourself, you'll be ultra careful, but it'll take a lot longer than that job will normally do, and you will still probably lose some. And Paul, we're going to get to the cost of candles and per hectare. That's going to come up very soon. So those are the sort of pre-prepared things. Before we do the candles, I'm going to do a couple of things which only happen in Chablis, because then everything else after that will be everywhere. One of them is water aspersion, which is when you have pipes laid in your vineyard and you have them. They've even prepared in the 1980s, early 80s. They even built a whole new lake or reservoir in Ben so that they could then use that as the water source. Early on, they had some teething problems because little baby fish got into the water supply and blocked the pipes. But broadly speaking, you've got your pipes hooked up to the water supply. And when you know it's going to freeze, you turn the supply on. You've got to do it right at the start of freezing, even just before. What then happens is, with the freeze, a little bubble of ice forms outside your buds and other foliage. That stays at zero. The cold is on the outside. And as long as you keep adding water all the time the temperature is below freezing, the cold will stay on the outside. Your little bulb of ice will probably get bigger. But you've actually got to keep the water sprinkling away right through past dawn until temperatures are above freezing and the ice melts naturally. Otherwise, you'll actually do more harm than good. So if you get that water aspersion wrong, you've done yourself harm. It's pretty efficient. It costs a little bit to set up, and you are using quite a lot of water, but you don't have massive man hours. You just need somebody to supervise it, make sure it's switched on and switched off at the wrong time. The other thing they're doing there is underfloor heating, which is putting thermal cables through the vineyards. The main William Febb started doing it from 2004. The first systems was all on a loop. So you started your cable and you went up one row of vines, down the next one, up the one after, down the next one. It formed a loop. And it's not as powerful as what they use since, but it wasn't all that expensive to install. Now they just have single lines that go up each row and then metered a sort of box at the bottom. Those are more energetic, put out more heat. They're a little bit more expensive. But Didier Seguier, who is the main man at William Fev, he told me that over a 10-year period, they calculated that the cost of these cables is about 4,000 euros in the, what's the word in English, the amortissement, the devaluation of the capital cost of of buying the system, and another 4,000 euros a hectare for the electrical cost, counting the fact that they've had to use them in some years, not in other years, but some years they'll have to use them a lot. So we've basically got a cost here of 8,000 euros a hectare, which we will remember when we look at some other things. So I'm told, it's still a bit too early to tell, but I'm told that this year both those systems were effective in Chablis, and that the people who use them were happy with that. Let's go to the candles next, the warming things. These cost 10 euros per candle all in, 8.50 euros hors tax before VAT. And they come in the form of little metal cans, which you have to throw away and get destroyed, recycled, after you've used them two or three times. Inside those, you have a paraffin wax. So you can make the paraffin in different ways, but most people at this stage are still using paraffin as a sort of petrochemical derivation. So that's not great. And they do give off a little bit of a smoke, which smells disagreeable. And if you have any form of asthma, you are liable to choke a little bit if you're walking around the vineyards while they are burning. So they aren't great news in that way. They are very labour intensive. You've got to send your team out, first of all, to put them in the vineyards. You've got to send your some of your team out to light them and keep them lit through the night. Each one will last 8 hours. Now, in a minor year, a radiative frost year, you probably don't need to light them till 4 a.m. and you can extinguish them at 7 or 8. So you can probably get 2 nights worth. This year, if you lit them at 10 or 11 in the evening, which you probably needed to do, you're actually going to run out before dawn and you've actually got to go through and replenish them. So it's really very, very demanding in lots of different ways. I've done a few calculations. Somebody asked about how many you should use per hectare. It's a minimum of 300, and double that is recommended, and some people say more like 800. I should be able to show you a little picture of them in action. This is up in Merceau Blenny. Here we go. So that's now coming up to dawn, and you can see that it's every third or fourth row, and it's about every 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about every 8 vine. So if you were every fourth row and every 8 vine, that's coming to 300 per hectare. But you can see from that that actually it's really only the vines and the 2 rows either side of each pot that's getting a significant benefit, particularly when it gets properly cold. If it were -1 or 2, maybe that would be enough. But the 2 rows in the more in the center of the picture weren't really getting any benefit at all. And when I went back and revisited this plot 2 weeks later, you could actually work out pretty much where there had been these candles, because you could see a few little bits of green appearing there and none in the other parts. So let's just run the calculations on that. So let's say that you needed 2 smudge pots because you had 2 nights worth, 2 full nights worth, or 3 lesser nights, and you went for 600 per hectare. That's 600 times 2 times 850, that's 10,200 euros per hectare. So it's slightly more than the thermal cables were, and it is also going to be less effective. It'll work with radiative. It didn't really work in the advective frost, and it wouldn't work once you get anything really below -4. People in Chablis, where I suspect in many various areas, it depends where you were, but in the Grand Cru and Premier Cru, I think it didn't get quite as cold as that. And they report reasonably good results from the candles. A number of my friends in the Côte d'Or said they didn't really make much difference this year. Sorry, sick time. And they're ecologically not great. So that photo was taken in Meursault, Blagny, La Pièce sous le Bois. And thank you, depreciation was the word I was struggling for just now. Other ways of heating, there was something which was done, it wasn't so much for heating, it was for a slightly different reason. But people noticed after the 2016 frost that any vineyards where there had been a bit of cloud cover didn't suffer, and anything where the sky had been clear got absolutely massacred. And the reason for this was that the temperatures had gone down a little bit below freezing, let's say -2, -3 at maximum. The vines were definitely suffering, but some of them, they were just about at the limit, they could be all right. But if you then have the rays of the sun come up first thing in the morning and there is frost and ice around, the ice acts as a magnifying glass and it absolutely grilled the already fractionally damaged buds. So for example, Dominique Lafont told me that in his Meursault Porrezo Premier Cru, he got badly hit and made a tiny yield of around about 5 hectolitres a hectare. Meursault Genévrier, which is absolutely next door, I mean, we're talking 50 to 100 yards away, but there happened to be some clouds which covered Genévrier, Charmes, Perrier, and the beginning of Pinot Noir at Combet and so on. They had cloud in the morning, and he made a full yield in his vineyards there, so 50 hectolitres a hectare, 10 times as much. So people scratched their heads and thought about that, and come 2017 and through to 2019, after which it was banned, the idea was people got together collectively, they put lots of bales of straw by the side of the vineyards, they damped them down a bit, set fire to them, just damped them enough and kept dampening them so that they would make more smoke rather than just burn up. And from the period slightly before the sun rose through to the dawn and a little bit after, they burned these things. That again is not great ecologically, and in particular it was a more specific danger that there was a big thick pall of dark smoke and it was dangerous on the roads. You couldn't see, so people going to work or taking the kids to school, there was an active danger. So people realized that they'd used this in the short term, but it was not satisfactory for longer term, and that it was agreed that that had to be stopped. So that's gone the way, and the warmth from the hay bales probably helped a little bit. The photo you saw was taken on the morning of the 7th of April, so the morning after the snow shower. Now, you can warm your cold air up, or you can try and move the cold round and hope that you've got something warmer sort of coming up next door. And that is the point of wind turbines or helicopters. So you used to see a long time back something looking like a big telegraph pole up with a couple of blades on it, looking, I suppose, a little bit like those of you who remember the steam age of the railways and the signals before they turned into lights, looking a little bit like that. There was one at the Château de Puligny-Montrachet, there's one below the Château de Beaumont-Romanée as well. And then you would set them to turn and they would disturb the air a bit. Nowadays, you have much more impressive turbines, which can be, some of them are solid structures, but some of them can be folded away. And a lot of them are smallish ones, which are mobile. And so you take them to the bit of vineyards, and they're supposed to do up to 4 or 5 hectares at a time. This is unsure. So you probably got to get together your mates, or else you find that you are doing their vineyards as well as yours for free. The sensible thing would be for the communes to work together and agree to do it, agree to buy several. They're quite expensive. They cost between, depending on the model, between 30 and 45,000 euros each. So you need to amortize that over a number of years. It's probably not that dissimilar a cost to the electric cables. But actually, no, it is different because these are supposed to do 4 or 5 hectares. The problem is, in this year's advective conditions, they were stirring up one bit of cold air and just other bits of cold air took their place. So they weren't really warming things up. You can light a permanent fire with wood underneath them so that they will actually be blowing warm air around. And some people did that, not everybody, but some people did that. And that might have had some effect. But the general opinion that I'm hearing is that it didn't do much good. I don't have an exact cost, but they must be reasonably costly in fuel, electricity. I bumped into Boris Champy yesterday, and he said, the thing is, the ones we saw in the vineyards here are French make, and they are 35 horsepower, but the ones he was used to in California, because he used to work for Dominus in California, were massive. They absolutely guzzled up fuel, petrochemical fuel, but they were 350 horsepower, and they really did make a difference. So maybe if we had some of those in Burgundy, maybe that would be more helpful. But they aren't there at the moment, and those would get pretty expensive, and who knows if they would still work in a bad advective frost condition. So anyway, they were a failure this year. They're not particularly great ecologically, but they don't take a lot in the way of manpower. Just switch them on. Switch them off again later on. Helicopters sound really expensive. They go on sounding expensive. Etienne Griveau, who is a helicopter pilot himself, called up some professionals and got them to come over. He's got a decent holding of Clovugeau. He talked to Jean-Nicolas Mayo, Mayo Camuset, who have a big holding, and also to the Chateau de la Tour, who have the biggest holding, and they're all in the same half of Clovugeau, and they agreed to share the cost of a helicopter. They got a professional in. There's a call-out charge, and then the cost is 27 euros a minute, which sounds an awful lot. But they flew for 90 minutes, covering 10 hectares in all. And so my calculation is that's not very much divided by the 10 hectares. If we bring it down to an hour, the hourly cost per hectare is 162 euros an hour, plus there'll be a few other costs, as I say, the call-out charge. But it's not vastly expensive. It does stir the air up. The helicopter basically goes as slowly as it can go and not be stationary. It's also both the whirring of the blades and the engine of the helicopter is giving you a little bit of warmth too. It flies in a sort of serpentine pattern over the vineyards. And what you need to make sure you do is when you finish, you get to the top of the block, you don't immediately turn around. You've got to take a big loop round and then start again at the bottom. So he's, when I saw him a week afterwards, he thought that it probably had been helpful. And in any case, Clovugeau, we're talking about the Reds, so they are later in how they start out. So it may have been all right. I didn't see any other helicopters or hear of them in the Côte d'Or. There may have been some. It's certainly a definite option. What have I got left as possible options? I know. We've got also, this was something that was started in Chablis in the mid-1990s. People put massive tarpaulings covering big, big blocks, and they'd leave them up for anything up to a month. And then the authorities said, no, we don't like that. We're going to stop you doing that because who knows what's going on underneath the tarpaulin. You're changing the microclimate, i.e. the area immediately adjacent to the vines. And that's not something you should do with sort of Appellation Controle rules. So they got banned, and then about 2 or 3 years ago, they got allowed once again, but they can only be for short term. And I think they limit the size of any given one. So this is a photograph I took on Friday last week in Chablis Grand Cru Les Clos. And the Grand Cru of Chablis, actually, with lots of different protective methods, came off not too badly. What I hear at one remove, but apparently the guy who put these up is not happy at all, because when it was as cold as it was, the cold air could get in underneath the tarpaulin and it then got sort of locked in place. So he thinks he may have done actually worse by having the tarpaulins, or bâche in French, than he would have done otherwise. With all these things, we genuinely don't yet really know quite how bad it will be. There will be some secondary buds and shoots. Then the question is, will they actually have any grapes on them or not? So we'll only know that later on. Mark's asked, on which level of classification? Well, the thing is, all these things are quite costly, so people only do them Grand Cru and their best Premier Crus. For example, I talked to Guillaume Michel, who is the main Louis Michel in Chablis, and he used it in his Grand Crus, and he thinks he saved them. He used them in the Monte de Tonnerre and the Voleron, and he thinks he's probably saved those. He'll have losses, but not disastrous. But elsewhere, some of his other Premier Crus, he didn't feel he could protect everything with cost profile. And so he didn't put any in his, he has Montmartre, Forêt, and Buteau. He says, oddly enough, his Buteau Vieille-Vigne survived. His other block of Buteau, which is just as old vines, but he doesn't call it that, didn't survive. And some of the Montmartre and Forêt, which are lower down, were okay, but anything that was exposed up towards the plateau definitely suffered. And frankly, we're talking about, if we talk about a cost for some of these things of 10,000 euros per hectare, and that was really only for one night's protection or a couple of nights' protection, and you might need more than that, you get a standard yield is going to be half a bottle of vine, of wine per vine. So that's 5,000 bottles. So you're talking about €2 a bottle. Now, if you think that your Petit Chablis is selling at €5 and your Chablis at 5, 6, 7, 8 euros, you can't afford that. So very few people will have done the more competent protective methods on their village Chablis or indeed on their Mâcon Village. So Paul has said he's seen a Chablis in Puligny, a helicopter in Puligny near the Bâtard Morrochet. Well, that's good. And of course, if somebody's using a helicopter, they are definitely helping their neighbours as well as themselves. Again, it's something that might be beneficial for the commune to buy. The other thing is, if you're into plant therapy, biodynamics, and the rest of it, some people were out spraying their vines just before the frost arrived. I heard from the Domaine de Sellier-en-Moine in Givry that he was out there in advance, and lots of people afterwards sprayed valerian, which has a warming potential, along with this I got from Pierre de Benoit, also in the Côte Chalonnaise of Domaine AMP de Vilaine in Bouzeron. But he also mixed it with comfrey, yarrow, and nettle because they have sort of restorative tonic qualities. Whether these things work or not, I have no idea, but the people who use them will doubtless say that they did better in those plots than in others they didn't. And in fact, Pierre has told me that where he did the traditional methods of piling up the soil around the foot of the vine and of pruning very late and not tying down, and he does that in two of his Ruli parcels, which normally otherwise would get a little bit damaged, which are Grésigny and Margoté, he said he's actually come out with a better result there. Another thing that you should do in advance is not plow shortly before. If you plow, you get a more humid soil, and that the cold air is attracted to. And I was speaking to Madame Chiquetot, and she was a bit upset that in the very narrow 4 or 5 rows wide plot of Les Saint-Georges, they had not ploughed and they had put their candles in, and nobody else in Les Saint-Georges had used candles, and the two people on either side, the strips on either side, had just ploughed a few days before and had not used candles, so they were really attracting the cold air. And she was not optimistic at all, sadly. So we've covered much of what I wanted to say. I've got a couple more things to continue with and have a think about any other questions you'd like me to cover on the Q&A or on the chat, because I would like to stop promptly on the hour if we can get there. So in terms of who suffered worst this year in Burgundy, Chablis is pretty bad, but it seems as though the preventative measures in the best vineyards have done all right. But up on the plateaus, places like Courgis and Preuilly, and into Saint-Brie and the satellite areas, it's I'm afraid it's going to be difficult this year. In the Côte de Nuit, white plots will have suffered just as badly as the Côte de Beaune. The reds, a few of the early plots, perhaps a bit, but on the whole, most of the buds hadn't come out. But they have been very reluctant to emerge since, and everything is a lot further back, and we are definitely not going to be in August harvest this year. And that pushing back is slightly worrying, because I think people would have expected more to have come forwards a little bit more quickly than has been the case. And it may be we're going to find a reduced crop, even if it wasn't actually frosted. Sometimes the buds, instead of forming into bunches of grapes, they depart en vrille in French. They just turn into little tendrils instead of into bunches of grapes. I can't give you prospective harvest dates yet, much too early for that. We have to wait and see what the flowering is, and then thereafter how the season goes. But nobody now would be expecting before mid-September. Who knows, it could get pushed back later than that. After all, it's not that long ago, 2013, when we had what was in fact pretty much an October harvest. Dennis, this shouldn't be enduring damage in 2022 and 2023, but it does matter a little bit. If the vine got really badly hurt, then it's going to struggle to form the shoots which would form the following year's crop. So it's possible there will be localized damage that can go beyond one system season. But we do also know that when the vine or any fruit plant suffers very badly one year, it tends to yield very generously the following year. So after the 81 frost, we had a bumper crop in 82. After 91, a huge crop in 92. After 16, there was a huge crop for reds at any rate in 17. And your other question about the Chablis water treatment, risk burning in the morning sun. Not really, because you're continuing to put water on until the ice has melted. So it's only on the outside. And for some reason, no, it doesn't go through. It doesn't affect, act like a magnifying glass onto the bud beneath. But sensible question to ask. So let's talk about the aftermath then for this year, including going back to Davide's original question. So we've talked a little bit about the after treatments of the herbal concoctions for some people. Insurance will look after some people, but it's very expensive, and more people, whether it's for hail or for frost, are saying, frankly, it simply isn't worthwhile. The government has indicated that it may step in, wait and see how bad the damage is, but it may well be that the government will either reduce people's taxes, as it might be equivalent of taxes on wages and various other things to help people. I think the government will try and give the region some help, consider it a regional disaster, which would be good. People are already trying to estimate the damage, but it's never the same as the first estimates. I think it's really important that we do avoid too much catastrophe talk. Of course, the volume is going to be down, but it doesn't have to affect the quality of the crop. Now, I feel this quite strongly because you may remember that 2016 was my first vintage of working with the Auspice de Beaune as their guy who's supposed to be out there promoting the wines and the sale on behalf of the auction house. And we had been talking catastrophe disaster so much from April onwards that nobody was ready to listen to the fact that the wines could be good. in the end, I don't think the whites are great in the white wines, not great in 2016, partly because there was a little bit more of a secondary crop. You've got a bit of a first crop, bit of a second crop. People picked when the first crop was a bit too ripe and the second crop wasn't quite ripe enough, and you had a slight sweet and sour effect. But the reds turned out to be very concentrated and really magnificent wines, I think, the 2016 red wines. So it's perfectly possible to get very good quality grapes. Then will it affect prices? Well, it certainly means that when people come to do their 2020 prices, they ain't going to go down and they may go up. Now, we expected prices to come down for either 2017 or 2018 because yields have been so low, 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, you understood why prices went up. 2017, big crop, perhaps they'll come down. Well, no, but okay, fair enough. Maybe people need to recoup what they lost in the previous years. But then with 2018, also a big crop, we definitely felt prices shouldn't go up, but they certainly didn't come down. They haven't come down for 19, haven't gone up too much, but 20, wait and see, but they aren't coming down, they'll probably go up a bit. So in terms of price from the cellar door for the new vintages, this is not going to be particularly happy and healthy. I didn't think it would make much of a difference to prices for wines already out in the marketplace, but I happened to be tasting in a grower about a week after the frost, and there was a chap who is an expert for auction houses here in France, and one of his companies was running an auction in down in Côte d'Azur the following Saturday, and he said he'd already seen a lot of pre-bids where people had placed a bid for one thing and they'd come back and they'd raised their bid by 20%. Now, I suspect that that's not really going to be there in the long-term market, but it is slightly an issue. I'm reluctant to talk about pricing of either percentages of losses or percentages of price increases, but we can talk a little bit about tendencies. The OSBs won't order their barrels until quite a bit later on, and so in common with other people, they will trim what they buy. It was a problem for people who placed their orders very early in 2016, and they honoured their orders. They had barrels sitting completely empty. So, I mean, in order to dispel the gloom, I think you have to be a glass half full rather than a glass half empty. And indeed, Ben LaRue said, what I like to think about what I've done in the vineyards is that instead of losing half the crop, I have managed to react and save half the crop. And I said, well, actually, this year you're going to be a glass 15% full instead of a glass 85% empty. It's a bit naughty of me. And the only other thing going forwards, because if this pattern is here to stay, can't be sure of that, but it's got to be a reasonable expectation that it's going to be with us for a few more years yet. We don't know if this is a temporary macro climate change or whether it is something that is liable to stay for future years. But when you replant, nowadays, you need to think very carefully. And this will be beneficial for the frost at the beginning of the season, and it will be beneficial for the hot mid and late seasons. You need to be thinking about a root stock, a Portographer root stock, which is a late delivering root stock, and also a clone, if you're using clones, of Pinot or Chardonnay, which again are late ripening clones. And that way, you will start your season later, which is good, and you'll get to your harvest later, which is also good. So, Paul says a glass half empty means you need more wine, but basically whether your glass is half full or half empty, there'll still be room for more wine in it. So, I have managed to keep talking without too much hesitation, repetition, or deviation, I hope, for an hour. It's been a real pleasure for me. I hope it's been instructive for you. We have been recording it. It will appear as a podcast later on. It will appear on our website. If you're listening in and you haven't already signed up to join JMIB, Jasper Morris Inside Burgundy, it will cost you £95 a year, but we would be delighted if you would enjoy to do that. and stay with us, and we'll endeavour to do more of these whenever we think there is a topic which is worth going into in quite some detail. So I'm going to sign off in a second and pour myself a very proper full glass of wine. But thank you for joining. I'm told the weather is going to warm up significantly this weekend, and I, for one, am absolutely ready for that. So good night, stay healthy, enjoy wine, and we will speak again. Bye-bye.